Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 22nd of July 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 45 in our series here where we look at the white connection to civilization, and in particular for the last about a dozen episodes we've been taking a very close look at pre-Roman, pre-Saxon British history, and we're just sort of coming to the end of that now, but we're not going to stop looking at British history. We're going to move into the Saxons after that. Tonight we're going to be talking about Queen Helen of the Cross, and of course I do have with me my co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, how are you doing? How's your week been?
Hi Sven, yeah, I'm well, thanks. It's been good. The weather's extremely hot, and I work from home, but in my kind of, it's like a studio thing, a studio room, and it's just very hot. It's either cold in winter or boiling in summer, like a greenhouse.
It has been the hottest weather I think we've had in years, and of course they keep complaining about climate change, but we forget that we had a hot period in the Middle Ages. We used to grow wine here. I think in Roman times it was much warmer than it is now, and of course right. We have to switch the fans off, don't we, when we're recording, so we have to put up with this heat. Yeah. For our listeners, and I hope they do appreciate that, the lengths that we go through to bring them these podcasts. Right, as I say, we're going to be talking about Queen Helen of the Cross, and we're going to be quoting from R.W. Morgan's The Cymry, and we're also going to be quoting from the nationalcv.org.uk that I recommend people go and have a look at. That's a very patriotic site devoted to history. We'll begin with the quotes from R.W. Morgan. He says, "Pius, the Bishop of Rome, thus announces the martyrdom of St. Timotheus not long after his return from Britain. The holy Timotheus and Marcus, presbyters who were educated by the apostles and who have survived to our time, have given up their lives in the good war. They rest in peace in their beds. Pastor or Hermas, the minister of the Titulus, was crucified at the same time. Timotheus bequeathed his palace, grounds and baths to the church at Rome." And of course that was the British church at Rome, and the good war that they're talking about there, I guess they're not talking about the British war against Rome, they're talking about the war between good and evil. And Hermas, which it says here, is the minister of the Titulus. He was the minister of the British church at Rome, and he was the famous pastor of Hermas, I think, or something like that. There's a famous apocryphal book that was written by him that we discussed a while back. Do you want to comment on any of that, Patriarch?
No, the apocryphal book. I think at the time I remember, was it the one where it was about a lot of different visions that he had?
Yeah, the Shepherd of Hermas, wasn't it? The Shepherd of Hermas.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess it must have been similar to John's Apocalypse then.
Yeah, pretty much.
That was a style of writing back then. The next year, Pius, that's Pope Pius, or the Bishop of Rome, Pius the Bishop of Rome, was admitted to the same crown of glory. And 9 years afterwards, Polycarp, another contemporary of the apostles. The monasteries of the British church were on a scale of grandeur never since rivaled. There are three perpetual choirs, state the triads of the Isle of Britain. Great Bangor in the forest of Maelor, Car Salog and the Crystal Isle in Avalon. In each of these are 2,400 servants of Christ singing night and day without intermission, 100 every hour in rotation, so that the praises of God are sung without ceasing from year's end to year's end. And Car Salog, I think that's Salisbury, the Crystal Isle in Avalon, that was Glastonbury. So they were saying that the original form of worship was chanting, I think, like the Benedictine monks when they would chant.
Chanting? Oh, yeah, yeah. I've heard some. I played a computer game with a really good computer game. It wasn't religiously inspired. It was called the Talos Principle. And they had some really epic music, and there were a lot of kind of chants and sort of Christian-esque type sounds and monk sounds. But yeah, I think they've got a certain resonance to them, the chants, and it's almost like, have you heard of that that kind of frequency-based music where you kind of reverberates and taps into the kind of the soul or something like that?
Get your body vibrating in the same frequency. I was just thinking it that may have been the origin of the male voice choirs, which we still have today. I mean, Wales is famous for its male voice choirs, and apparently this goes all the way back 2,000 years to the first formation of the monasteries. And as it was saying there, the big monastery at Bangor was based in the original Druidic university there. So they may well have had chanting with the Druids as well. That may have formed part of what they were doing. The foundation of Bangor preceded that of any other monastery in Europe or Asia by above a century. I take, writes Sir Winston Churchill, Bangor, endowed by King Lucius, to be as the first, so the greatest, monastery that ever was. I say not in this island, but in any part of the world, whose foundations were laid so deep that none of the Roman emperors in the following centuries, although for the most part violent persecutors, could undermine it, their religious continuing safe in the peaceful exercise of their religion until the entrance of those accursed pagans, the Saxons. And eventually we'll get to that, what the Saxons did to the Bangor monastery. And as we pointed out before, this wasn't the Winston Churchill we know. I think it must have been his father or his grandfather that was writing about this. But this shows that 150 years ago, this was accepted history. King Lucius was the first proper Christian king to endow the country with churches and monasteries and to pronounce the nation as being Christian. And that was an accepted part of history. And also it must have been accepted that we had these great monasteries, and it was the greatest monastery that ever was. And people just don't know that today.
And what year does that say? AD 607?
That was when it was destroyed by the Saxons, AD 607. It was Lucius was in about 150, wasn't he? We worked out last week.
Yes, what he's talking 150. So yeah, that was the when it was the first initially pronounced, but then we also learned that obviously it was Christian from pretty much the offset.
It was, I mean, there were Christians there in Britain from the arrival of Joseph of Arimathea soon after the crucifixion and the resurrection, basically. The heads of Bangor were generally men of the highest rank in the state. At one time, 10,000 teachers and students were connected with it. Every graduate was obliged to master some profession, art, or business. It was the National University for Agriculture, Theology, Science, and Literature. Its destruction by the Saxons in AD 607 forms one of the gloomiest pages in our insular annals. Its colleges and churches covered a square of 5 miles from gate to gate. And that's interesting because, you know, you get the atheists today that will criticise the church and claim that the church is anti-science, and yet this was one of the first monasteries. And it was a university, and it was all about teaching people agriculture, science, literature, and theology. It was all about learning. They were learning how to write, and they were keeping all the information that was needed, all the records, all the histories. They weren't anti-science. They weren't anti-knowledge, because the whole point of what they were doing was that you would look around you at nature and the natural world, and the natural world is the proof that you need for there being a God, is just the natural world. And the more you look at the natural world, the more complex it becomes, and the more it becomes impossible for there not to be a God. I mean, that's the logic behind it.
Yeah, I think science obviously split off from religion from the kind of the liberal movement, the French Revolution, I guess, around that time. Would you agree?
Yeah, well, I think it's actually not quite right to say that the church is against it, because they said that the church was against Galileo because he was saying that Earth wasn't the center of the universe. But I don't think that was true. I think there was I mean, I'd have to look into it again, but it was some part of what Galileo was doing that wasn't actually proved correct, and I don't think they punished him. And it's not quite true the Earth moves around the Sun anyway, doesn't it? Now it depends where you're looking at it, whether the Earth is the center of the universe. It depends where you're measuring it all from. Because the whole universe is constantly moving around, isn't it? So even Galileo wasn't correct. And I think the point that the church would make is that only God is truth. Man can try to get there, but he can never know for 100% whether he's actually at the truth of something. God is truth, isn't he? Christ is the truth. So it's arrogant for man to claim that he knows it all.
Yeah.
Henceforth, to the fall of the Roman Empire, a few only of the most striking events demand notice. In AD 178, Lucius sent Elvan and Medwin, bishops of London and Llandaff, to Eleutherius, a bishop of Rome, to obtain authentic copies of the Roman Code of Laws. Eleutherius, with great wisdom, urged him, as the sole vicar of God over his people, to have nothing to do with such a code, but to make the New Testament the secular, as he had already made it, the ecclesiastical basis of British legislation. This sound counsel was followed, and since that time Christianity has been, as it still is, not only the religion, but the law of Britain. And that's the bit that I was referring to last week, because the modern historians will claim that this is when Lucius became Christian. He sent these two emissaries from the court to Rome, to Eleutherius, to ask Eleutherius to send people back to baptize him and tell him how to be a Christian. And that's not actually what the records say. They say that Elvan and Medwin that went over to Rome, they were actually bishops already. And what we have here, he was saying, not saying that Britain should follow the laws of Rome, but saying Britain shouldn't follow the laws of Rome. Britain should follow the Christian law, which is what the common law is based upon anyway, or it used to be.
Yeah. And Rome was quite happy with that. We mentioned last week, because obviously we established that Britain was actually a very civilized nation, and obviously had lots of civilized things, institutions, universities, and religions, and industries.
Rome was quite happy for us to keep our laws, because they were sensible laws as well. That's what we pointed out, wasn't it? Lucius died AD 190 and was succeeded by Cadvan, Prince of Venedotia. In AD 181, the Antonine rampart between the Friths of Clyde and Forth was stormed by the Picts and Caledonians, the Roman commander slain, and the country ravaged as far as York. They were defeated by Ulpius Marcellus, and their territory between the Forth and the Tay was reduced to ashes. Marcellus was succeeded by Perennis, Perennis by Pertinax, and Pertinax by Clodius Albinus. So there isn't really that much happening, but you can tell there aren't any wars going on, because there's no real records for this time. So it must have been pretty peaceful, apart from what was happening to the Romans here. In AD 194, the British legions elected Albinus emperor. He crossed the straits against his rival Severus, received the submission of the greater part of Gaul, and held his court for some time in Paris. The next year, April the 21st, he encountered Severus on the plains of Lyon. The victory, states Herodian, appeared at noon to be decided in favour of the British, the centre of the enemy being routed, and Severus himself having fled in disguise from the field. But fresh forces came up, and attacking the Britons in the disorder of pursuit, retrieved the day. Albinus was beheaded, and the British legions conducted back to Britain by a lieutenant of the conqueror, Virius Lupus. Now, I'm guessing last week we were talking about this, and we said that the Britons weren't going to fight for the Romans unless it was actually on British soil. But what's happened here is Albinus, the British legions elected him as the emperor, so they were supporting him. And I don't know if this Albinus was related to the British kings, because that would be a reason for the Britons to leave the country and follow the emperor if he was a British king, because that is what happens later on with Constantine. It says here they just elected this Albinus emperor, and there must have been a reason for that. I'll have to look into that for next week.
Maybe what happened to the who was the group that that were kind of traitors to the native Britons, and then later Rome kind of sided with them. Perhaps he was just another kind of mole or someone that was willing to do their bidding.
I think there was a Corynidae. It was Mandubratius was the traitor, and then there was his tribe, wasn't it? It was one of the London tribes, and then there was the tribe of Boadicea as well. She came from one of the traitor tribes, and I think she was from the Corynaid. It will probably come back to me, but I can't recall the exact name of it. It may have been related to them, but I would have thought that he was related to more of the Cymry tribes, for them to support him as the emperor and to want to fight in Gaul for him. The Picts, taking advantage of the disaffection which ensued, invaded the province. Lupus bought them off with a heavy payment, the first instance of the suicidal policy, which afterwards became rather the rule than the exception with the Roman Empire towards its barbarian assailants. Severus was not, however, of a spirit to sanction such a disgraceful act. He immediately came with his two sons to Britain, repaired Dover and the rest of the southern fortresses, advanced to Albion, now becoming better known as Caledonia, and in three campaigns carried his arms to the very extremity of the island. The expedition cost him 50,000 soldiers, but the strength of the Picts and the Caledoni was for 40 years effectually broken. So they've managed to conquer Scotland now, make their way right the way across it, and it's starting to become known as Caledonia.
But the Picts were already present in Scotland, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Picts were. We talked about them a bit last week. Yeah, the Picts were present, but they were providing a bit of a resistance to the Romans.
They probably, as a culture, just got amalgamated into the peoples that settled later.
Well, this was happening a lot, actually. If there was trouble in one part of the country, the tribes from the other parts of the country would then come down and make of it what they could. You know, when the Saxons came in, the Picts would come down and cause problems. And when King Arthur was abroad in Europe again, I think it was the Picts and the Saxons that started causing problems in Britain. But if there's trouble in one part, then the other tribes that aren't actually part of the Confederacy are going to take advantage of that and try and capture land for themselves, I guess. And that's what these Picts were doing, taking advantage of the disaffection which ensued. In AD 145 to 211, the Roman emperor, the founder of the Severan dynasty, who came to Britain in 208 to pacify a country engulfed by a succession crisis caused by King Lucius dying without male issue, one of the local contestants in the civil war brought in outsiders. This ultimately prompted Severus to mount a Caledonian campaign on the line of Agricola's in the first century and to reinforce Hadrian's Wall. Edward Gibbon, in his chapter 5, describes Severus as that warlike and successful emperor who yet was judged by posterity to be the principal author of the decline of the Roman Empire, as he bloated and debauched the military with favours. His Caledonian War, Gibbon opined, was neither marked by decisive events nor attended with any important consequences. Though Gibbon makes no mention of it, the British histories claim that Severus became King of Britain. Holinshed's Table of Kings ceases with Lucius, yet another king list from the Tudor period carries the story forward. So this is explaining what happened. There was a problem after Lucius died because he didn't have a male heir. So this is why there's this fighting that's taking place. And this Caledonian campaign, I mean, this may be the reason why this Albinus was put in place. I think this is coming from the National CV now, rather than R.W. Morgan. Nennius wrote that, we are informed by the tradition of our ancestors that 7 emperors went into Britain. The 2 before Severus are Julius Caesar and Claudius. Unlike Severus, they are not in the above list, presumably as neither reigned as monarchs in Britain. The local perspective is summed up thus. Therefore, to use the speech of another late author, Severus, by birth a Roman, but in blood a Briton, and the lineal heir of the body of Androgeus, son of Lud and nephew to Cassibelan, was emperor and king of Britain. And that's a source from Enderby. So he's saying that Severus was by birth a Roman, but by blood he was a Briton, and he was one of the line of the kings, basically. And Androgeus, that's Mandu Bratius that we spoke about. Androgeus was a traitor who collaborated with the Romans during their first invasion. He departed to Rome, where he prospered. His younger brother, Tenventius, took the British throne, but Androgeus's line was senior. In this analysis, when Tenventius's line died out with Lucius, Severus became a candidate for the throne. Androgeus's genealogy is not available to support this material, but Severus seems to have issued a decree saying that none born of British blood should afterwards be king of Britain. Source Enderby. And that was presumably to knock out the local rivals. So he's trying to set it up so that only his line can be king of Britain, I think, Severus. The Brit, written after the names of Severus and his 2 sons, refers to Britain. So it's Severus the Brit. Yet there is more than British antecedents in the British histories. Severus was widowed and then married another woman. The British historians say that his first wife was a Briton of very high lineage, suggesting that Severus's first marriage had been a dynastic match. The Roman records say that Severus died of old age and was buried at York in 211. Enderby reports, improbably, that Severus was slain in battle by Fulgenius, or as others call him, Fulgentius, brother to Severus's first lawful true wife, the Empress Martia, a Briton. And Enderby notes that Empress is inappropriate, as Martia, in fact Paccia Marciana, was married to Severus roughly in the period 175 to 186 before he became emperor in 193. For a religious anecdote about Severus's death from Enderby contradicting a battlefield death, it says here, see Hyperborea. So that'll be something else there. On the line of Hadrian's rampart, he built the Wall of Severus, the northern boundary of the empire. It extended with fortresses at fixed intervals across the island from Wall's End to the Irish Sea, a stupendous work equal to what would be the circumvallation of London and its suburbs, with their present population of 2,800,000 inhabitants. Severus died July the 4th the following year, AD 211, at York. And in AD 228, Cadvan was succeeded in the sovereignty by Cole, or Colus, his son-in-law, whose favourite residence was Colchester, and this would be Cole 2. Remember we talked about Cole 1, Cole 2 and Cole 3 last week?
Yeah.
So this is Cole 2. And in AD 242, his daughter Helen, afterwards the Empress and mother of Constantine, was born in that city. AD 260, Constantius, the nephew of Claudius Gothicus the Emperor, a young man of 25 years of age but who had already attained high military rank in Spain, was commissioned to arbitrate in certain differences between Cole and Asclepiodatus, Duke of Cornwall. Cole, refusing to submit the question to arbitration, Colchester was besieged by Constantius. Matters were, however, arranged, and the siege terminated by the marriage in AD 264 of Helen with Constantius, who thus, on the abdication of their claims by her brothers, became in her right the heir to the throne of Britain. So we have Severus is the Roman emperor, and he's also the king of Britain, and he dies, and he was put in place because Lucius died without issue, basically, without a male heir. And then when Severus dies, we get Cole. He's succeeded by Cole. This is Cole 2. Cole 2 gives birth to Helen, the Princess Helen, and Helen ends up marrying Constantius, who also ends up becoming the Emperor of Rome. So you can see there's all these intertwined lines between the emperors of Rome and the aristocracy of Rome with the royalty of Britain. And that's because the royalty of Britain was descended from Brutus, and the royalty of Rome was as well. But of course they murdered their royalty at some point. That's when they became a republic. But if they could marry into the royalty from Britain, they could have a claim to the aristocracy. And this story here, I mean, it's saying that Constantius came over because there was he needed to arbitrate between Cole and Asclepiodatus, the Duke of Cornwall. Well, that's one history, but there's another history as well, that this Constantius, he would dream of this beautiful woman, and he was searching for this beautiful woman, and he came to Wales and discovered that the beautiful woman was actually in Wales, in Carnarvon, and this beautiful woman was Helen. And he married her in Carnarvon, and he built the castle there, and he brought the soil from Rome there, and he ruled the whole of the Roman Empire from Carnarvon. And that's the legend that they have at Carnarvon Castle. Right. And that legend also got picked up on by Edward I, and he got fascinated by all of this. And he saw himself as being a similar king, or playing a similar role, being the emperor of Britain, of Scotland, Ireland, Wales and England, in the same way that Constantius was the emperor of Rome. So he saw himself as he saw that the Britons liked this Constantius, and he was their king, even though he was Roman. And Edward I thought, well, these Welsh, they've got to like me as a king as well. If I liken myself to this Constantius, they're going to be more inclined to like me as well. And he really tried to ingratiate himself with the Welsh, but they kept rebelling. So in the end, he actually took out their princes and took the princedom off the Welsh and took it for himself. And that's why the Prince of Wales is always the eldest son of the monarch of England. But he did try, and he was, as I say, he was fascinated by all of this history and also the history of King Arthur. And he set up a round table, and he would have the jousting with the knights, and he tried to turn his court into Camelot. So he understood all of this history, going back to the King Constantine, back to Brutus.
Yeah, King Arthur was also a descendant of Brutus, right? He must have been, if he had a claim to the throne.
Yeah, and Constantine. I mean, I was just bringing this up because...
So there was all basically kind of trying to claim stake to it, really.
Yeah, I mean, that proves that it was... You know, it was a genuine claim. But if you go to Carnarvon Castle today in North Wales, you'll hear about this history, but it won't tell you that it was Constantine the Great was their son. But it will tell you about this beautiful Princess Helen and the emperor that married her, and he dreamed about her. But I think they call him Maxentius. But it was actually this Constantius, because I think there was three at the time. There was Diocletian, Maxentius, and Constantius. And they were a triumvirate that were all ruling Rome at this time.
Yeah.
And it was Constantius.
I'm looking on Google Maps now. It's kind of quite near to it's Warrington, isn't it? Past there. I think not so far from Manchester, basically, north of Wales, but across a river from
Carnarvon.
Manchester.
Yeah, Carnarvon is the place. Carnarvon. It's in North Wales, and it's where Prince Charles had his investiture. If you look at Prince Charles, when he was made into the Prince of Wales, when they put the crown on his head and they dressed him all up, they actually did it at Carnarvon Castle, the original castle that Edward I built.
Wow.
Because that's what it should
be. I wonder why that is then. I mean, maybe that goes to show that it has a tradition, at least among the royals.
Well, because it goes all the way back to... this Constantius, who built a Roman castle there. He built a Roman palace there at Carnarvon. And then he ruled the whole of the Roman Empire from that part of Wales. So Edward I, he built a big castle there as well, and said, well, and then I can rule the empire from here as well. And my son, the prince, can be the Prince of Wales, and he can rule from here too. So he was sort of making himself out to be of the same caliber and the same type of person as Constantius, the emperor of Rome, and also keeping that tradition going of that part of the country being an important part of the country. And it's fascinating to have all this history that goes all the way back. You know, and you think, you know, we used to have rulers that loved all of this, and you know, and we used to love all of it, and were fascinated by it, and now they try to rubbish it and pretend that it doesn't exist, and oh no, we're all multicultural, we can't be proud of that. You know, we need to be inclusive.
Only the culture that's being kind of washed away or, you know, decimated. Now, did I tell you I went to Nottingham Castle a couple of months back? It's a reopening and, you know, it was improved in some ways, but it's like, it feels like if you're going to pay tribute to a British history, you have to bring a bit of balance and make and appease, you know, other ethnic groups. You can't really go full front and all out kind of, you know, glorifying or paying homage and putting all the focus on white culture. You have to kind of partition it, even in the gallery. There was, you know, your traditional paintings, and then they had these just random ethnic people, like photographs of, you know, modern photographs of facial portraits, just kind of wedged in between, totally misplaced, in between these elegant kind of, you know, classy paintings, you know, from centuries ago. It's just so, like, off the mark. It's just unbelievable. It's quite annoying, really.
Yeah, it sounds like a complete anachronism. You know, it's like we can't be proud of our glorious past because we were horrible racists, so we can't be proud of it, and we've just got to forget about it and not talk about it. I think that's why it's important we have this series and talk about this history, because it's also been covered up, because there's been a concerted effort to deprive the Welsh of their history, the Britons of their history, and that's been going on for, well, about the last 1,000 years. And as I say, yeah. Edward I didn't. He tried to keep it going. But what they did when the Welsh princes were locked up in the Tower and they had all their genealogies, this Saxon monk burned the Tower down, and he burned down all the genealogies, and they lost a lot of their family trees. But then this history did become known through Geoffrey of Monmouth, and it was known as the history of Britain right up until about 1800. And then they said, oh, Troy doesn't exist. Troy is just a complete fantasy. So all of those histories is rubbish. And of course it's not. I mean, we said last week that second century quote from Eleutherius about the people of Britain coming from Brutus. And that's from the second century. But then in the 18th century, they said, oh, this is all rubbish. It's all fantasy. Troy doesn't exist. And then they discovered that Troy does exist. Well, they said it didn't. And then they found the remains of it. And they found that it did exist. But by that time, the damage was done. And they said, you know, this is all makeup. It's all made up.
Yeah, they were trying to pit it in sort of the light, within the likes of the city of Atlantis, kind of like a hidden or lost world that just becomes a fairy tale.
Exactly. But I mean, you've got the Romans saying that they came from Troy. You've got the Britons saying that they came from Troy. You've got the Greeks saying that that they had parts of their aristocracy came from Troy as well. And they were all Trojans. And then you've got these lines that go all the way down. And this bit here with St. Helen, she was very important. But we'll get into why as we go along here. We'll talk a bit about her now. AD 248 to 330. The British princess and one of the most distinguished individuals in all of British history. She also has one of the finest titles, Queen Empress St. Helen of the Cross. The true telling of the true story of this British noblewoman is one element in the rectification and reinstatement of British history by the National CV Group. Helen has been the subject of a triple misrepresentation as being one of non-British birth, two, the daughter of an unidentifiable innkeeper in the northern Mediterranean area, and three, the concubine of the Roman general, later emperor, to whom in fact she was actually married. For the interlocking evidence against these malassertions, the original motivation behind this scurrilous codswallop was probably not misogynistic diminution of Helen, but a retrospective attempt to delegitimise her son, Constantine the Great. The aim was to maketh that most noble Constantine to be a bastard begot out of marriage, and so disableth him to have been the heir of Constantius, either king of Britain or emperor in Rome, when all men know he came to the imperial dignity by right of inheritance, for as Cassiodunus is able to witness, it is but a pagan report, and raised first by Zosimus, that most malicious ethnic, and railer against Constantine, for professing and advancing of Christian religion, and renouncing idolatry. The source for that is Enderby, and he says Zosimus was a Byzantine historian writing circa 500 AD, and Cassiodunus was Cassiodorus, a Christian monk of Italian origin, who wrote in the 500s. So we've got evidence from 500 AD about why they tried to hide the fact that Helen was a princess, that she was the daughter of old King Cole, because they wanted to delegitimize Constantine. Confirming Helen was the daughter of the British King Cole II, who we discussed last week, the great-granddaughter of Lucius of Britain, the first Christian king, and the great-great-granddaughter of the second century old King Cole of nursery rhyme fame. She married the Roman general Constantius Chlorus in 274, and their son Constantine was born in 275. He was born within wedlock and therefore legitimate. Constantine was to be their only child. Now we have another quote here from R.W. Morgan, another of his books, St. Paul in Britain. The first part of the 4th century is the era of Constantine the Great and his mother Helena. Gibbon, with the perversity which beset him as a mania in dealing with the leading facts of Christianity, strives to persuade himself that Constantine and Helen were not Britons, but natives of some obscure village in the East, his sole support for such a supposition being the fragment of an anonymous author appended to Ammianus Marcellinus. The man must be mad, states Baronius, who, in the face of universal antiquity, refuses to believe that Constantine and his mother were Britons born in Britain. Helen was unquestionably a British princess, writes Melanchthon. Christ, declares Pope Urban in his brief Britannia, showed to Constantine the Briton the victory of the cross for his sceptre. So R.W. Morgan provides three quotes there from way back. I mean, Ammianus Marcellinus, not quite sure, probably 500-600 AD. So he's saying there is support for this going all the way back, that Constantine was a British king and his mother was the Princess Helen. Note, in connection with this quotation, Gibbon is Edward Gibbon, the author of The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, published 1776 to 88. The obscure village is Nasus, now called Niš, in modern-day Serbia. Ammianus Marcellinus was a 4th century Roman historian. Baronius is Cardinal Baronius, 1538 to 1644, the greatest historian of the Roman Catholic Church, whose allegiance to the truth was legendary, making him an inspiring figure for the national CV group behind this website. Melanchthon is Philip Melanchthon, 1497 to 1560, the German Lutheran scholar, and Pope Urban is Pope Urban VIII, 1568 to 1644. A chronological confusion runs through the British histories in regards to Helen and Constantius. What is missed, though not by Enderby, is a visit to the island in 273 by Constantius on behalf of Emperor Aurelian to reassert Roman control, and it is on the following year that he and Helen marry, in London, according to Geoffrey of Monmouth, and here is what the Tassilo Chronicle has to say on Helen. And Constance took Helen as his wife, she being the only daughter of Cole, and she was surnamed Helen the Fair, for such beauty of face and figure had never before been seen. And a son was born to them, whose name was Constantine, the son of Constance. And this is he who wrested Rome from the hands of Maxon the Cruel, he and his three uncles, his mother's brothers, who were called Iolinus, Traherne, and Marius. Here is another recounting the same. the old tradition of the Chronicle and numerous other independent records that the famous Christian empress and canonized saint Helena, the mother of Constantine the Great, was a British princess, the daughter of King Cole. And that's L.A. Waddell that is writing there. And here is the view of Holinshed, who mentions Colchester, the capital of Britain in the Roman era, which was Helen's birthplace. That noble emperor Constantine, an assured branch of the Britons' race, as born of that worthy lady, the Empress Helen, daughter to Cole, Earl of Colchester, and after King of Britain, as our histories do witness. Referring to old King Cole of nursery rhyme fame, Helen's great-great-grandfather of the AD 100s, there is this in a well-researched history. The building of Colchester is ascribed to this King Cole the First, which is the chiefest city at this day in Essex, wherein Lucius, Helena, the daughter of Cole II, and Constantine, the first Christian king, empress, and emperor in the world, were born, which made Necan to sing as he did. From Colchester there sprung a star, the rays whereof gave glorious light throughout the world in climates far, great Constantine, Rome's emperor bright. And that's again from Enderby. So we've got all this proof for this. Do you want to add any comments to this?
I didn't know about the Colchester being the capital during the Roman times, but I had a quick look and this looks to be some fantastic remains and architecture from then. You know, really beautiful castles. Like, literally, you'd think you're in Rome. But obviously, it's in Colchester. I might have to pay a visit there.
Yeah, I think Boadicea sacked it as well. I think that was one of the cities that Boadicea destroyed was Colchester. It was very important back then.
Yeah, but it's not really on the... Well, it is on the map, but, you know, it's not really famed for much, is it? No one really talks about going to Colchester too often.
No, I mean, it's not a famous place now. I mean, obviously London is still big. Yeah, it makes you wonder because it said that there were 40 university cities at the time, you know, at the time of the Druids. And most of them are still there, but obviously not as important today as they were back then. We'll have a little look at Helen herself. Helen was an ardent Christian from a royal dynasty of Christians. And during the reign of her son Constantine, she undertook a pilgrimage to the Holy Land on the basis of purportedly finding the true cross on which Christ was crucified. Helen then became Saint Helen of the Cross. The Queen, in Helen's title, Queen Empress Saint Helen of the Cross, derives from her rule in Britain with her husband Constantius Chlorus until his death in AD 306 when she ruled on alone in her son's absence. She was a real British queen. Britain has the greatest tradition of queens regnant in the world, and within that tradition a history of long-lived queens. Helen herself, Elizabeth I, Victoria, and Elizabeth II, the present sovereign. Helen's ardent Christian beliefs, her high birth, and the ultimate greatness of her son Constantine make her one of the most influential figures in the history of the West. The birth of Christendom was a British affair. So she is called St. Helen of the Cross because she supposedly found the true cross. I mean, once Constantine made the empire, made Christianity legal throughout the empire, and he made Constantinople into his city, Byzantine, he made that into his city. He also went out into Jerusalem and started building churches in Jerusalem and digging around there to find the evidence for all of this. And this is what Helen did. And she dug down, and I think it was under a pagan temple, and she believed that she found the crucifix, the cross of Christ. And there was a miracle. Someone was brought back to life, I think, by lying on this cross. And she's got the nails from it. And the nails from it were put into a crown that was part of the British crown that had one of the nails from the cross that was on it. And in Wales, there's a part of Wales where they have various names to do with the Queen, like the place of the cross, Constantinople, Bethel, all these religious names to do with the Old Testament and also to do with Constantine. And there's a place that's called the Pilgrim's Cross. And you can see where people over centuries have kneeled down to kiss what looks like a cliff face. And there's like an indented cross in this cliff face. And it's called the Pilgrim's Cross. And people have knelt there to kiss this cliff face. And Wilson and Blackett have looked into it. And if you look at it, this supposed cliff face, it's not. It's very, very cleverly made dry stone walling. It's a wall face. There's obviously something behind it. And the theory is that the cross, the piece of the cross which she found, is residing behind this Pilgrim's Cross. And that would explain why it's all worn away from people kneeling down to kiss this wall. Because why would you kiss a wall that just had a cross on it? You know, it's on part of a pilgrimage route.
Yeah.
There's a village nearby and it's called the Place of the Cross. And then you've got this Pilgrim's Cross. And if you look at the pictures of her, like all the medieval pictures of Helen, they always show her carrying this cross around, and that's why she's called St. Helen of the Cross. So where did the cross go? Where did it end up? Where was it hidden?
Who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, what are the chances, though, of it being the exact cross of Christ? I mean, there must have been loads of crucifixions at that time.
Well, it's probably unlikely, isn't it? But I mean, there was miracles that were supposedly linked with it. I mean, that's sort of how they would tell that these things were genuine, because there would be miracles that happened.
I just wonder if this was kind of during the formation of a lot of sort of religious sects that kind of, where kind of money and rituals and kind of, you know, they try to soil the faith in many ways by creating these kind of idolatry figures or things that they could, you know, draw attraction from.
Yeah, that's a good point. I wouldn't say there were so much sects, but yeah, certainly holy relics, and then charging people to look at the holy relics or to come close to the holy relics and, you know, and be healed by them, that sort of thing. That may have been going on, but I think she was genuine. You know, I think she was genuine.
Yeah, perhaps. I'm just trying to be often quite cynical in some ways.
You can add it with cynical modern eyes. Yeah. Of the cross.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love it to be true. It'd be great. But I just think the probability and I mean, I don't know how it would be proved, you know, other than, you know, like you say, if there's miracles, I mean, that would be proof enough if you saw something crazy happen. But, I don't know. The chances are it's likely not to be the exact cross.
Yeah, I doubt that was a metal plate saying this was the cross that Jesus was crucified on. But there was probably somebody there that was convincing, that managed to convince her, or she would have been searching around saying, well, I've heard this is where it is, and you know, the people that were digging around, maybe they wanted to please her, and you know, they came up with something. I mean, what is it? I think it was Edward I who commanded that they dig around in Glastonbury, and then they supposedly found the grave of King Arthur there, and Edward I opened up the grave, and it was King Arthur. Now, I'm not quite sure how they were able to tell it was King Arthur. He was apparently 9 foot tall or something as well. But they managed
King
to arrange
was
it.
9 foot.
Well, according to them, yeah. I mean, they managed to arrange it so that Edward I could discover the grave of King Arthur at Glastonbury. I mean, that's another legend. Wow. So if you were royal and you were looking around for these things, you expected to find them, you know?
Yeah.
So somebody did find a crucifix. And she was convinced.
Sure. It's
was
like the
way.
Cloud of Turin, isn't it, though? It seems like a similar story. And then there's hype and drama around it.
Oh, the Shroud of Turin.
The Shroud of Turin, yeah.
Yeah. Well, after the marriage of Helen with Constantius in 264 AD, Constantine the Great was born the following year, in AD 265. It was the custom of the Roman emperors to nominate their successors under the title of Caesars. Diocletian, the reigning emperor, nominated Constantius Caesar in AD 287. Britain, at this period, was thus governed. The Viceroy of the Emperor resided at York. Under him, the administration was conducted by three consulars and two presidents. The military organisation was under three generals. The first, the Dux Britanniae, the Duke of Britain, had the command from the Humber northwards. The second, Comes Britannia, the Count of Britain, was answerable for the state of the garrisons and fortresses in the interior. The third was entrusted with the defence of the coast, from the Humber southwards to the Land's End. All this coast, from being opposite to the great Saxon Confederation in Germany, was known as the Saxon Coast, and this officer was therefore entitled the Count of the Saxon Shore. As Imperial Admiral, he had the chief command of all the naval forces of Britain. This important position was now filled by Carus or Carausius, a Venedotian born at Minidon on the banks of the Menai. Being disappointed in his hopes of the Caesariate and resenting the elevation of Constantius, he threw off his allegiance and proclaimed the independence of Britain. So once again, you've got intrigues here. You've got Constantius being nominated as Caesar, and then you've got this other general, chief command of the navy, who thinks that it should have been him. So he's throwing off his allegiance and saying Britain's now independent. The Northern and the Channel fleets, and then the legions, declared in his favour. The Saxons enrolled themselves his subjects, receiving from him, in return, that naval discipline and training which subsequently made them the terror of the western coasts of Europe. To Carus, or Carausius, must be attributed the glory of having first seen and realised the true policy of Britain. He first made her Queen of the Ocean. He reigned 7 years over the united kingdoms of Britain and continental Saxondom. His fleets ruled the seas from Gibraltar to the Hebrides. The number of coins struck in his mint, which has come down to us, exceed those of any other emperor. Maximian, the colleague of Diocletian, was defeated by him in his attempt to invade Britain. But 3 years afterwards, this truly British sovereign was assassinated by his minister Electus at York, and the island, on his death, invited Constantius Caesar to take possession of the throne. Electus was slain near London. Constantius never again quitted Britain. His favourite seat was Car Seant or Carnarvon. He died at York AD 306, and in his will he ordered his body to be interred at Carnarvon, and his tomb was removed within the church in the time of Edward I. So Edward I wanted to honour him there. So we have a king here that I had hardly ever heard of, this Carausius.
They're saying
was the source of Britain's first real navy, and he even had the Saxons under him. And the Britons supported him at first, but then once he was killed, they supported Constantius, the father of Constantine. And remember, at this time, there was Constantius, Maximian, and Diocletian. There was this triumvirate that were ruling Rome. Because now we get to a persecution. None of the first nine Roman persecutions of the Christians extended to Britain, but the 10th, under Diocletian, which raged for 18 years over the rest of the empire, was put an end to in Britain in less than a year, at the risk of civil war with his colleagues, by Constantius. Amongst its victims were Amphibolus, the Bishop of Llandaff, Alban of Verulam, Aaron and Julius, Presbyters of Caerleon, Socrates, the Archbishop of York, Stephen, the Archbishop of London, Orgulius, his successor, Archbishop of London, Nicholas, Bishop of Penryn, Melior, Bishop of Carlisle, and between 10 and 15,000 communicants in different classes of society. So what was going on here, Diocletian was persecuting the Christians, and that went on for a year in Britain. Mm-hmm. It was the first time that had actually happened in Britain, and Constantius put a stop to it. And it was actually at this time that St. George was around, and this is where the legend of St. George comes in, because St. George was friends with Constantine, the son of Constantius, Constantine the Great, he was good friends with him, and he served with Constantine in the Persian War, I think it was. And mm-hmm. he actually came to Britain. That's why we have St. George's Channel between Wales and Ireland, and that's why we have St. George's Cross. I think it's on, it might be on the Heraldry of Liverpool, one of those port cities. But he apparently came to Britain to see Constantine. And then he went back to the Lebanon, because that's where he was from. And he was also a relative of Joseph of Arimathea. He was obviously white, basically. And he went back to Lebanon. And because he was a Christian and he refused to renounce, Diocletian tortured him. And they did all sorts of horrible tortures to him, put him on a wheel, put him on a rack, filled him up full of lead. I think they beheaded him in the end. They like absolutely horrific tortures. And he refused to recant right until the end. And because he refused to recant, even Diocletian's daughter said, this man's got incredible courage and strength, and she became Christian. And then when Constantine was actually made king and he made Christianity the religion of the Roman Empire, he wanted to honour his friend George. So they canonised him and they made him into St. George, and he made St. George the example of manhood for the Roman Empire. And they built the Chapel of St. George in Jerusalem. They put loads of churches up for St. George, and they had his relics as well. There was St. George's hand was in a church in Libya, and it was still there, actually, until we ceded that revolution, which got rid of Gaddafi, and the Islamic extremists damaged the church there, and they damaged the relics, because we actually had St. George's hand in the church out there in Libya.
Really? Wow. Yeah.
And St. George was like, and this is why St. George is the patron saint of England, because he was the best buddies with Constantine. So it does actually make sense. And then again, all of this got picked up on and encouraged after Edward I. So they say the Saxons weren't interested in it. The Saxons weren't, because it basically gave a claim to the people that they had just conquered. It gave them a claim to a history and to the island. So the Saxons weren't interested in it.
Yeah, I mean, the fact they're persecuting Christians goes to show how much the sort of Roman control had, kind of came over Britain. I mean, because we know the ancient Druids were kind of more welcoming of different religions and Christianity in general. So I think, Rome. The Roman culture must have been more prominent at that point in time to be so heavily persecuted.
Yeah, I think that Constantius was just being sensible. You know, if you could continue to do this, there's going to be massive unrest. So, and it was, there was unrest. I mean, that's what I think led to the unseating of Diocletian. Diocletian ends up dying, or something ends up happening to him. I mean, it wasn't a good idea to start persecuting the Christians. And then Constantius dies. No sooner was the death of Constantius known than the British legionaries elevated his son Constantine, then in his 31st year, on their shields and proclaimed him emperor. His career may be read at large in Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Educated by his mother in the Christian faith, he had early formed the resolution of putting Christianity over the whole extent of the empire on the same foundation as it had long occupied in Britain. The scheme was carried out with unerring sagacity and unflinching perseverance through the arduous campaigns of 20 years. His pagan competitors, Maximian, Maxentius, Maximus, and Licinius, succumbed in succession to his victorious arms. His legionaries, chiefly selected in Britain from his hereditary domains as being Christians of the British Church, supported him throughout with admirable loyalty. The example of his father was his guide through life. His mother Helena he always treated with the utmost respect and affection. He well explains the great objects of his life in one of his public edicts. We call God to witness, the Saviour of all men, that in assuming the reins of government, we have never been influenced by other than these two considerations, the uniting all our dominions in one faith, and restoring peace to a world torn to pieces by the madness of religious persecution. So up to this point, the Romans had been trying to fight against Christianity, and he turned it on its head. He expired after being 18 years sole disposer of the Roman world at his palace near Nicopolis, AD 337. Next to King Arthur, Constantine may be regarded as the greatest of the British emperors. He was the founder of secular Christendom. British bishops attended the synods of Arles and Nice, held AD 314 and AD 325 during his reign. The Catholic Creed of Nice, adopted in a synod of all Christendom with a native British emperor presiding, is the only creed beside the apostles of the old British church. Interesting stuff. So that's R.W. Morgan just briefly telling us about his life. Before we go into the sources for Constantine the Great, do you want to add anything to that, Patriarch?
No, I don't really have any questions for that one.
That's all right. We can get straight into the sources. AD 275 to 337, the Roman emperor from 306 until his death, Constantine the Great was a pivotal figure in the history of the West as he legalized Christianity in the Roman Empire. His mother was British Princess Helen, the daughter of King Carl II, meaning that Constantine was half British. Constantine's father, Constantius Chlorus, and his mother reigned as monarchs in Britain after Cole's death. After Constantius' own death in 306, Constantine took the throne alongside his mother. And then we have the quotes here. And St. Bede confesseth from Eutropius that Constantine succeeded his father in the kingdom of Britain. So that's Enderby, and he's saying Bede writes about this. And this is he, Constantine, who wrestled Rome from the hands of Maxon the Cruel, he and his three uncles, his mother's brothers, who were Iolanus, Traherne, and Marius. That's the Tassilo Chronicle. Constantine, who reigned 30 years and 10 months, was the flower of Britain, for he was British, both by birth and country, and Britain never produced his equal, before or afterwards. And that's Henry of Huntingdon in 1129. Constantine and his mother were members of a royal Christian dynasty, which is why Constantine chose Christianity as the Roman state religion. It is said that Constantine was even educated in a British monastery. And we have a quote here again from Enderby. These monasteries were all destroyed in Diocletian, his persecution, including the monastery of Abingdon, where this, our great king and emperor Constantine, as the old annals thereof do plead, had his education when he was young. This great emperor had an especial care of restoring and endowing this, his nursing place of education. So Diocletian even destroyed his old monastery. Constantine married Minervina, who has herself been claimed to have been a British princess, like his mother. And the source for that is Wilson and Blackett. When Constantine left his mother's native Britain to fight two other rival claimants to the imperial throne, his mother Helen followed. Constantine became a renowned emperor of Rome, legalizing Christianity across the empire and calling the doctrine-deciding Council of Nicaea in AD 325, at which he personally presided. Constantine abolished crucifixion and built the original St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, by dint of a mother's Christian influence. Britain, which had become the first officially Christian nation in the 2nd century, gave Christianity to Rome. It was not the other way around. Via Helen and Constantine, Britain brought to a close the pagan era in the history of the West. Constantine decreed in 321 that on the venerable day of the sun, the law courts and all workshops should be closed and the urban population should rest, creating the Christian day of rest and worship, which is still known as Sunday. Constantine considered Troy for an eastern capital, which would have coalesced his Brutus of Britain and Aeneas of Rome heritage, but he chose Byzantium instead, renaming it Constantinople. And it turned out to be a wise choice, since the city lasted a millennium beyond Imperial Rome. It fell to the Turks in 1453, and was held by them until November 1918, when British troops, on behalf of the victorious Allies at the conclusion of the First World War, were the first to march into what by then was called Istanbul. It's such a great shame that we lost it to the Turks, isn't it? Well, in AD 369, an invasion of the Picts and the Scots was repelled by Theodosius. Scotia, before the 9th century, means Ireland, and the Scots, the Irish. After the conquest of Western Caledonia in the 7th century by the Irish Scots, the country gradually became known by their name. So Ireland used to be called Scotland, and Scotland used to be called Ireland. In AD 383, Maximus, grand-nephew of Constantine the Great, assumed the purple in Britain and appointed his son Owen Findu Caesar. Under Maximus and Helen, daughter of Eudav, Prince of Cambria, his wife, the last of the three silver hosts, quitted Britain for the conquest of the continent. Conan of Powys Meriadoc, the cousin of Helen, was created by Maximus, king of Armorica, and from him descended the dynasty of the Breton sovereigns and dukes, terminating in the 15th century in Anne of Brittany, twice a queen of France. Gaul and northern Italy were subdued by Maximus. He fell at last near Aquileia in Italy against Theodosius, 26th of July, 388. The remains of his army settled amongst their countrymen under Conan in Brittany. So that was another huge load of people that actually left Britain around about this time, which would have weakened Britain and made it much easier for the Saxons to come in. Yeah, there was also a comet as well.
Where did they go?
Well, they went into Europe. That's what it's saying here. This the last of the three silver hosts to quit Britain for conquest of the continent. And that's where the royal line from Armorica comes from, and the Breton sovereigns and dukes that ended up in Anne of Brittany. Gaul and northern Italy were subdued by him, and he fell at last near Aquileia in Italy against Theodosius. So, again, that was Britain's, all the warrior Britons basically went into Europe, leaving the country undefended. In AD 406, Britain finally separated itself from the Roman Empire, electing Constantine, grandson of Conan of Armorica, for its sovereign, and thus, as it was the last to yield, was the first also to reassert its ancient independence and nationality. The Roman government of Britain lasted 286 years. The Cymry, or leading tribe, were never entirely reconciled to it, but it does not appear in any material degree to have interfered with their military precedence, two of the three legions being constituted of Cymric levies and stationed in their northern and southern capitals, Chester and Caerleon. And that pretty much finishes the Roman history, and the next section in our British history is the Saxon history. So I don't know if you want to add any thoughts to that today, or what we've been talking about so far before we finish.
The point made about Ireland being called Scotland and Scotland being called Ireland, can we elaborate on that at all? I mean,
it comes from Scotta. Scotta was an Irish princess, and that's where the name Scotland comes from.
Right, so we mentioned last week that they were quite related, the Picts marrying into the tribes and whatnot as well. So so I guess that just adds confluence to the connection, doesn't it?
And what it is saying here is up to the 9th century, Scotia, when you spoke of Scotia, you were talking about Ireland. And when you talked of the Scots, they meant the Irish. But then the Scots that were in Ireland made their way into Caledonia. And Caledonia then started being known as Scotland. See, it says here, after the conquest of Western Caledonia in the 7th century by the Irish Scots, their country gradually became known by their name. So the Irish came up through what is now Northern Ireland into Glasgow, into Scotland, settled that area there, and they took the name of Scotia with them, which was the name of an old Irish princess, an Irish princess that was related to the princesses of Judah that was brought to Ireland by Jeremiah the prophet. So that's where that bit ties in. It was the name of the princess was Scotta, and that's where Scots get their name from, Scotland, from this Irish princess. But that is a bit of history that I think we'll do a whole episode on.
Yeah. Well, all in, I think from what we've covered so far, our connection to Rome is kind of like we were in many ways a sister nation.
Oh yeah, we weren't this barbarian backwater. You know, we were equals with them pretty much. Our kings were emperors, and their Caesars you had to marry into the British royalty so that they had a claim to being Caesar. I mean, that would give you a claim to being the emperor if you had ancestry with the royalty from Britain.
Yeah. I mean, they were very race conscious as well, weren't they? So, you know, they wouldn't just be marrying willy-nilly. There had to be some roots there.
No, it's all about breeding. I mean, there's this Constantius Chlorus. He had to divorce Helena and marry this other daughter of somebody that in order to become Caesar at one point, mm-hmm. like a dynastic marriage. If you want this position, you have to marry this woman, so you'll have to divorce Helena. I mean, I think he got it back or whatever. I mean, obviously Constantine, when he became emperor, when he became king, he made his mother the empress, and she was still there ruling. I mean, it wasn't because Constantius Chlorus, you know, no longer loved Helena. It was he had to marry this other woman because their marriages were seen as business arrangements. Actually, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is going to do an Orthodox nationalist episode on this. He was telling me the other day, this idea of harems, it wasn't the idea that we have. I mean, these women were there as hostages, you know, they couldn't be violated in any way. And he was telling me that these marriages weren't looked upon in the same way that we would look upon marriages today, because you hear of a woman that's, the invaders come into the country and they take the woman, the princess or whatever, and they take her away. They wouldn't be sleeping with that princess. They wouldn't violate that princess. And those princesses were like hostages. And that's why you had these harems with thousands of princesses in them. They were all hostages.
Waiting to be married,
you were under honour not to do anything to them. I mean, it's interesting stuff. I'm hoping he's going to do an Orthodox nationalist on it. But that, that does take us a little bit off topic here. So I think we'll leave that here for tonight. So thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
You're welcome. Thanks for another insightful episode.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I believe it will be the PA monthly update next week. So until then, we hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.